Hi, welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm your host, Jeff Bloodworth. January has got to be a really, really difficult month for Mitt Romney. I think we've seen, and heard and read that this is definitely a difficult time for conservatives in the GOP in the wake of, well, what they thought was going to be a November victory, which turned into a defeat. Take heart, Mitt Romney. I hope you're listening out there. Take heart, GOP. Scott Faris has, at least, if the White House doesn't make you feel better, right, maybe this book will. It's called Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Scott Faris is a journalist who has some training in history, and he has written a really accessible and deeply informed book about losers at the presidential level in American politics and their contributions to changing America. And this is a really, I think, kind of novel way of looking at American political history. Instead of looking at, oh my goodness, there, you know, Abraham Lincoln, and we can all understand if we've seen the movie, especially, you know, how Abraham Lincoln changed America. But, you know, Scott Faris has, for instance, a chapter on Stephen Douglas. And so he goes through 19th and 20th and early 21st century American political history, sketching out how notable losers changed American politics through their campaigns. And he has a really interesting first chapter on the concession speech as sort of an agent of change. This is a fun book. In addition to being fun, it really is deeply informed. Scott Faris is somebody who's been covering national and state level races for decades. And so it really is. I mean, this is a historically informed political journalist. I urge you to listen to the interview. It was fun. It was wide ranging. Go out and buy the book and then read it. Hi, Scott Faris. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Welcome to New Books in Politics. Today we have on New Books in Politics Scott Faris, who has written a book, Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Scott, why don't before we kind of jump into talking about the book, why don't you tell us just a little bit about you, some biographical information, educational background, work background, things like that?
I'd be delighted to, Jeff. Well, first thing is, you should know I'm a native in Wyoming and spent most of my adult life there, which actually I thought was ended up being very helpful in writing the book, because Wyoming at one time was a fairly key early caucus state for both Republicans and the Democrats. So I had the opportunity to end up as a reporter, which I was in those days, meet a lot of the folks who ran for president over the last 30 years or so. And in Wyoming, it's not exactly a big media scrum, so you get a lot of one-on-one time. So I felt I got a pretty good sense of some of the folks who were running and who they were and what they were trying to do. And anyway, you wouldn't have gotten if I was part of the press corps in Los Angeles or Chicago or someplace like that. But I was a reporter. I had a journalism degree from the University of Wyoming, and I worked for United Press International, eventually rising to bureau chief in Cheyenne, which was the state capital, and then worked for some other Wyoming publications where I did a lot of political reporting. I also worked in the religious press. I know that Gannon's a Catholic university, and I worked for the Diocese of Cheyenne for a while as their communications director and editor of the Diocesan newspaper. But then I also have gone back and forth across the line between journalism and politics, and I have been an advisor to a U.S. senator from Wyoming named Malcolm Wallop, a former governor of Wyoming named Mike Sullivan, the former governor of California, Gray Davis, and the mayor of Portland, Oregon, Vera Katz. And so quite a spectrum there. Malcolm Wallop was in his time considered a pretty conservative Republican.
Yeah.
Vera Katz, as mayor of Portland, considered a pretty liberal Democrat. So I've worked along the gamut.
It sounds like it. I mean, between, you know, government and journalism, I mean, you know, I don't know. You've had an inside seat, you know, inside and an outside seat to kind of see a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I noticed in my acknowledgments not only the debt I owe to a lot of professors, because I also went back later and got a master's in history at UW, but also just the politicians who give me a chance to really learn the practical side of politics and how government works. And I think it helps inform the book and gives it, I think, not only sort of a scholarly feel, I hope, but also a very practical feel. But this is the real, really how politics works, and this is the real world implications of these campaigns and these candidacies.
Yeah, you know, I'm an academic and political historian, but I still, I think some of the best if not a lot of the best writing about political history comes from working journalists. You know, I don't know. You know, I might be kicked out of the academy for saying this, but it's like it's almost through osmosis. You see how it all works, rather than sort of having this ideal in your mind. I mean, what is your thought? Do you think a journalist, like someone with a journalistic background? I mean, this obviously gives you, you know, the sort of insights that people like me don't necessarily have.
Well, I think clearly as many life experiences you have helps inform your work and give it a different perspective and a broader perspective. But obviously you cannot write good history without a strong academic background.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think the best people who write the best books tend to be able to have a feel for the practical side, but also are really well-grounded in the theory and the scholarship around it. So
yeah.
I was really blessed, as I said, in my master's program. I had a wonderful professor named Bud Moore, who I think was fairly well-known nationally for his in academia. And obviously he gave me a depth of understanding that I had lacked. And then you layer on top of that the sort of practical experience. I don't think it helps, but I think he can get great work out of both tracks. And so hopefully people read both.
Yeah. I mean, this is what this book does nicely. I mean, and I was reading this over Christmas break, being stuck in airports and the like. And, you know, for those of us who, you know, let's imagine you don't know a lot about 19th century U.S. history, or alternatively 20th century U.S. I mean, if you want to have one book that you can sort of get, you know, at least the presidential synthesis, you know, presidential history of 19th and 20th century America, I mean, this is the book for you. Because you,
well, thank you very much.
I mean, it's a great cast of characters. I mean, what a great first of all, you know, how did you come up with this idea? I mean, you have a little story that you start off with in the book. I don't know if you want to share that story, but how did you come up with this idea?
Well, sure. It was from practical experience, personal experience. In addition to all the things I already mentioned, one of the other things I did that was kind of a crazy thing was I ran for Congress myself in 1998. So I am a failed political candidate myself. And it was for a congressional seat in Wyoming, which meant it was the only congressional seat, so it was a statewide race. And so fairly big deal. It was a seat Dick Cheney used to hold. Before him, Tino Roncalli, both a couple of people who made national impressions, obviously, especially Cheney.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you go into one of these things, and I was a long shot. I knew I was a long shot. I was running as a Democrat in Wyoming, and Wyoming's a very Republican state. But I gave it a good shot, and I ended up made at least a competitive race. And as you go through an effort like that, you end up owing a lot of people a lot of favors. I mean, you've been bothering your family and your friends and total strangers for their money, for their time, for their talents, and then you fall short of the mark and you feel like you've let people down a little bit. And so I was reflecting after the election, you know, did all this money and all this time and all this effort really mean anything? Did it have an impact? And so I was very curious to watch the person I lost to, a woman named Barbara Cuban. Did it change her a little bit about how she did her congressional role? And I think it did. She adopted some issues that I talked about. And so it made me think about the role of losing and can you have an impact? Is it really worth running? And the answer I came up with was yes. And then you had a series of very interesting presidential elections in 2004, 2008, and of course the most recent one in 2012. That was after I wrote the book, but it just made me think about this fairly important role that losers play in our political process. And not only is there a special role for losing generally in terms of making democracy work, and we can talk about that, but also some of these people I was thinking about, I suddenly realized, you know, they had a tremendous influence on our political history. And in some instances, as I argue in the book, they had a greater impact on American political history than some of the people who defeated them, or at least some of the people who became president. And as you said, there's a really fascinating cast of characters. I ended up focusing on about a dozen, well, nine who I thought really changed history, and then three people I sort of lumped together, Gore, Kerry, and McCain, the most recent folks. But nine people, beginning with Henry Clay and going through Ross Perot, who I thought really did change the political landscape in a very profound way, and I thought that was worth exploring.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, Ross Perot. We'll get to Ross Perot. We'll work through, not
sure.
We don't want to read the book to everyone, but let's work through this, because there's a lot of, I think, forgotten figures. And people who listen to this will be familiar with them. But, I mean, let's just, you know, I like your focus on the concession speech, right? I mean, now that I haven't Googled it or looked at WorldCat to see, you know, if there are books that look at the concession speech, but you just want to talk about that?
Sure, you know, the confession ritual was actually, I've become increasingly aware, it's kind of almost something unique to American democracy, and I think it is, as I argue in the book, one of the things that actually makes democracy work a bit. I was interviewed by a German magazine, which was interesting, and in the article that came out later, the author noted that a concession speech in Germany is unheard of, that the losing candidate in a parliamentary system almost never comes out and, you know, concedes defeat and moves on.
Yeah.
But I think in the concession speech in America, one of the things that has struck me is that we have this this very passionate exercise every 4 years of a presidential election, and people's tempers come to the surface, especially recently with the country so evenly divided.
Yeah.
And it's always amazing to me that in a country where we riot after the Super Bowl and the Stanley Cup and all these other things that you would think wouldn't mean too much, we don't see violence after a presidential election, even though people are just, you know, their faces are red and their veins are popping right up on election day. And then it's like everything just kind of calms down afterwards.
Yeah.
And the question is, why is that so in America when it's not true in some other countries where after an election you'll have riots and arson and even maybe sometimes civil war? And so what is the role? And one of it is the tradition we've established, thanks to some of the early losers, that, you know, you be gracious about it. You come out and you congratulate your opponent. You soothe your supporters and say, look, you know, we didn't win this time, but we'll be back in 4 years. We'll give it another try. Don't lose heart. And this is what my campaign did accomplish, and we should feel good about that. And it is sort of an interesting ritual. It's not a cliche. It's now actually a ritual, I think, where the losing candidate comes out, and it sets the tone for reconciliation after a very, very difficult campaign. And I do think it's that kind of key moment when people, it's sort of a cathartic moment when people sort of exhale, they feel better about themselves, even if they've lost, and we sort of move on to support the person who's won and try to get on with the business of governance. So it's, I think, in a very interesting ritual. It's overlooked, and yet everything stops election night. The winning candidate cannot come out until the losing candidate concedes. That's just now the way it is in America.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting just in this year, in November, when Mitt Romney lost, and it was obviously a surprise to him. All his polling told him he was going to win. And yet people were very anxious for him to come out and concede because they wanted to get on with it and move on. And yet nobody stopped to think about, well, why do we have to wait for him? Why is it important that we hear from Mitt Romney before Barack Obama comes?
Yeah.
And I hope the book, that chapter in the book, raises people's awareness. Oh, okay, this is why. This is this important step. This is this important ritual that makes democracy function in a nonviolent way.
You know, the first presidential election that I really paid attention to, and it's probably because I was able to vote, was 1992. And I'll never forget this. You know, I voted for Bill Clinton. I was excited when he won. But I'll never forget that Dan Quayle, I mean, he must have been introducing President Bush, but he mentioned Bill Clinton's name and people in the audience started booing. And I'll never forget this. Quayle kind of raised his finger and he said, no. If he runs the country nearly as well as he did his campaign, we're going to be all right. Why I remember that. I thought it was so gracious, you know, and from someone that, you know, at the time, I think we had fairly low opinions. Most, you know, many Americans had pretty low opinions, including myself, of the former vice president. And, you know, it always stuck with me. I thought, oh, well, that was really magnanimous. And, you know, and again, you're following this. That's what you're supposed to do in an American democracy. I mean, I guess it never occurred to me that maybe Dan Quayle was thinking actually the opposite. But this is very important. This is just what you do.
No, I agree. I actually do remember that as well. And I think that there are good examples of it. And again, it's so important. I think it is important to be gracious. And part of it is political self-interest.
Sure.
It's not all altruistic. A lot of these guys hope to run again, and they don't want to be known as a sore loser. That's not a tag you want to get in American politics. But it is important. And I think Nixon was another one in 1960.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking loss. A lot of allegations of voter fraud in Illinois and Texas.
Yeah.
And, you know, did Kennedy steal the election? And yet Nixon said, no, you know, we're in the middle of the Cold War. It's important that America be unified. And again, I don't want to be seen as a sore loser. So he came out. I also made a very gracious speech. And I think John McCain in 2008 gave another great example, as you pointed out, as when people started booing Clinton, and when Obama, when McCain came out and he mentioned Obama's name, his supporters started booing. Remember, he said, oh, no, 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 let's not do that. He's our president. He's my president. We now got to get behind him, and we've got to get the country moving forward. And that's why I thought a little bit, not to pick on him, because the poor guy's already been through enough, but Mitt Romney's speech, again, he sort of bragged on Election Day, you may recall. He said, look, I didn't even bother. I'm so sure I'm going to win, I didn't even bother to write a concession speech. And I think you could sort of tell that. He kind of threw something together at the last minute, and certainly wasn't ungracious, but it wasn't particularly generous, and it didn't really sort of rise to the standard where you say, wow, why didn't I vote for that guy? And I think that's a lot of things these losers don't need to remember, too, that this is their last chance to be the center of attention, at least for a while, and this is their last chance where everybody's listening to them, and this is a chance to really make one more sort of great impression and define your legacy.
Yeah.
Quayle improved his. McCain certainly did.
Yeah.
Romney didn't do his any favor because he didn't understand the power of the concession speech.
That's a very good point. I mean, let's jump into this. And I mean, this is somebody, you know, the great compromiser. I love it. Henry Clay.
One of my favorites, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about Henry Clay. What you know, the three-time loser. Talk about how he sort of, you know, why is Henry Clay, you know, the first example?
Well, firstly, I think, you know, Henry Clay can make a claim as being one of the most greatest Americans who never became president.
Yes.
I think we always sort of tend to measure American history by our presidents,
yes,
and our presidential administrations, but there have been a number of great Americans who never had the chance to be president. John Marshall would be one.
Mm-hmm.
George C. Marshall, another.
Sure.
Henry Clay would certainly be up there as an American. Alexander Hamilton, who were Americans who made enormous contributions to the country but never became president, and so we don't study them as much. We have sort of this unhealthy fixation on the presidency,
yes,
as if that's the end all and be all of our democracy. And,
yeah,
and I think Henry Clay was probably the greatest legislator in American history. He established the modern speakership.
Yeah.
He was a speaker as a freshman in Congress. Imagine if somebody who just got elected last year came in and beat John Boehner and now speaker, it would be a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened back in 1811 with Henry Clay. He just had such obvious gifts. And before Henry Clay, the speakership had been a ceremonial thing, just basically, you know, starting the sessions and ending the sessions. And Clay said, no, the speaker has a lot more to do than that. He gets to decide what bills get to be heard and what committees members get to be on. And so he became a very powerful speaker. Then he moved into the Senate with Webster and Calhoun, part of the great triumvirate, and sort of, just, as you point, the great compromiser. Three times forged compromises that avoided civil war, which probably was in the long-term interest of the nation.
Yeah.
But he also desperately wanted to be president, and so he ran many times. He was actually on the ballot, the general election ballot, three times, 1824, 1832, and 1844, and he tried a few other times besides that. Never won, but he did profoundly change American politics, and again, that's kind of the focus of my book. I don't just talking about all the things they did before or after they became a presidential candidate, but in his campaign, the reason I focus on Henry Clay is he created the modern two-party system,
mm-hmm,
because of his feud with Andrew Jackson. Jackson and Clay absolutely despised each other. It's amazing they never fought a duel. They said the nastiest things about each other you can imagine. It makes modern politics look pretty tame by comparison.
Yeah.
And so he was so sure that Jackson was going to become a dictator in the mold of Cromwell or Caesar that Clay developed this national apparatus, which became known as the Whig Party, specifically designed to try to defeat Andrew Jackson. Before that, there was only the one party, as you know, the Jeffersonian Republicans, that sort of, after the Federalists disappeared, dominated American politics for a generation. But Clay resurrected the idea that we should have two healthy parties, two big tent, mm-hmm, parties going against each other. And I think that's a real strength of American democracy. We badmouth the two-party system. I became convinced after writing the book that the two-party system is one of the great innovations in American democracy. But Clay was responsible for that. He created the Whig Party almost out of whole cloth. He was the only politician in America who really had the national standing to do so, and the genius, just a political genius. He developed the platform. It was called the American System.
Mm-hmm.
It was the natural tie between Hamilton and Lincoln.
Yeah.
Lincoln was a huge Clay admirer. In fact, he called him his beau ideal of a statesman, modeled a lot of his positions on Henry Clay's positions. And so Clay really creates this two-party system and creates the Whig Party, which evolves into the Republican Party. I don't see how he could be more influential than that. So that's why I start with Henry Clay. And I also start, by the way, because that 1824 election where Clay was one of the four participants was the first election where the popular vote really counted in terms of selecting a president. Before that, it had all been just state legislatures, and now it was back in the hands of the people. So I sort of view that also as the beginning of modern politics.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. Do you want to talk – I think this is a good point that you make about the genius of the two-party system. Do you just want to talk about, you know, what – what do you think the advantage of the two-party system versus a multi-party system is? I mean, I don't know if that's something you want to really get into, but would you care to talk about?
Well, I will talk about it because another one of the losers I focus on is Tom Dewey, who also wrote extensively and gave some lectures about why he thought the two-party system was important.
Yeah.
And why, and this is, I think, is very interesting to contemporary, given where the Republicans are right now, and they're sort of doing all this soul-searching, having all these retreats about how do we come back and start winning majorities in presidential elections again, is that Dewey and I think Clay, too, both knew that somehow you needed parties. In America, because of we're already sort of diffuse. We already have sort of it's a voluntary association. It's not like France or Germany where you have cultures that go back 2,000 years and you're drawing on that. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get people to voluntarily associate despite their different backgrounds and different interests. And so it's important in America to have two parties. You definitely need to have the competition. But the two parties need to be very big tent. They need to be broadly, not too ideologically oriented. They can't be too narrowly focused. They need to encompass a whole bunch of different beliefs.
Yeah.
And they have to each have sort of a reasonable, and because of that, they each have sort of a reasonable chance to win elections. Hmm. And that's another reason that keeps violence low, is that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you lose this time, you know that your party still represents an awful lot of people, and there's a very good chance you'll come back and win 4 years later.
Yeah.
So you feel you're not doomed to minority status, which builds a lot of frustration up and that could erupt into violence. And so I think that's really the genius of the two-party system, is that it ensures that you're always you have a very good chance of being on the winning team, and so you have a little more faith in the process. Whereas if you're in a minority, you don't. And surveys have shown this, that people who don't belong or don't identify with the two parties, or who identify with what we call a third party in the United States, have a much higher level of frustration and disappointment with the American democracy than people who are a Republican or a Democrat.
I think you've just described about 40% of every assistant professor in the United States.
That could very well be true. I mean, I think people think we don't have enough choices, but part of the genius of American democracy, why it functions, is that the choices are limited. But the theory, the choices are sort of in the center and representing center left, center right, so that you sort of feel an affinity for one side or the other, even if your full views aren't represented. And if they're not, then you should just run for office yourself.
And I think you made a very good point. I mean, one thing that I've always, is that third party candidates, if they're at all successful, one of the two parties are going to subsume their ideas. And one of the points that I'd never thought about was, that through the concession speech and actually through being an unsuccessful candidate, you can actually still force some of your ideas onto the other side just by losing. And do you want to talk about that just for a second? Because I'd never thought about that. And I think you're absolutely correct.
Well, let's jump to William Jennings Bryan, another one major figure in my book, and a very fascinating man, very misunderstood in my opinion. A guy who's mostly sort of known to the movie Inherit the Wind, as must have been this Neanderthal who didn't believe in evolution. And the book explains his reasons for opposing evolution, which actually were more political than scientific. And fascinating. But anyway, interesting guy. When William Jennings Bryan ran in 1996, he was only 36 years old. He had served two terms in Congress. And again, you sort of try to figure out a contemporary example. It's like somebody we'd never heard of from Nebraska or Missouri who wasn't even in Congress anymore suddenly came up and became the dominant figure in their party. Again, it would be a remarkable story.
Yeah.
But so Bryan runs, and of course he first steals from a third party, the Populist Party, adopts a lot of their ideas, which he's already been working on as a Democrat. But when Bryan runs in 1896, he is considered an absolute radical, and he absolutely terrifies more than half the country. Wall Street considered him a borderline Bolshevik, and they didn't talk about Bolsheviks. Anarchists would have been the epithet in those days.
Yeah.
But everything that William Jennings Bryan talked about in 1896 that changed the Democrats from the conservative party they had been, because the Democrats were the conservative small government party of the 19th century, into the liberal progressive party of the 20th century, Bryan achieved that. But everything that Bryan advocated in 1896 eventually became law. An income tax, a Federal Reserve, regulation of the railroads, labor laws, suffrage for women. All these things that seemed so radical in 1896 eventually were all adopted within Bryan's lifetime, most of it, and the rest of it shortly thereafter during the New Deal. So Bryan is a tremendous example of a losing candidate who was considered way outside the mainstream, and yet all his ideas eventually were adopted and now are just accepted. I don't think we're ever going to go back where six-year-olds work in factories again. I hope not. but Brian was the guy who changed that in a losing campaign, and is a real long shot. Just a fascinating. The 1896 campaign, probably the most exciting election in American history, even though the end result wasn't quite as close as some of the others. But in terms of just the enthusiasm and the religious fervor that it generated, unmatched in American history.
And really, on one hand, this was a battle between, kind of competing demographies in 1896, an ascendant urban industrial America defeating a slowly collapsing is not the word right. This is the right word, but defeating a rural white Protestant America.
A disappearing rural sort of society. And I think Brian tried very hard. He was certainly the precursor of guys like Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt,
who created
what we call the New Deal Coalition. He didn't completely understand urban America.
Yeah.
He had a chance to. He lived in Chicago briefly, but he hated it so much he left right away, which is too bad. He might have, if he'd really gone out and sort of got to know urban workers, he might have been able to address their concerns. But you're right. Part of it, he was viewed as maybe too as anti-Catholic, though he wasn't really. He was happy to give he spoke in Catholic churches. He admired the Catholic Church, but there was sort of a disconnect. But he laid that foundation that then, like I said, then Woodrow Wilson, then Al Smith, then Franklin Roosevelt, and pretty soon you had the 20th Century Democratic Coalition. But William Jennings Bryan was the one who started it all.
Yeah, I mean, this is your figures, I think, are outstanding because they're all these transitional figures. Bryan is the man who, if one person can span, the populist movement into what becomes, the progressive movement from working in the Wilson administration, which of course also employed Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, this is the person who kind of brings his followers into becoming progressives. And in the same way, Al Smith, and again, this is another, forgotten loser. You want to talk about Al Smith for a minute and sort of his contribution?
Yeah, I'd love to. And again, I mentioned that I once worked for the Catholic Church in the Diocese of Cheyenne, and Gannon's Catholic, so I think it's particularly important to look at Al Smith. Al Smith, of course, was an extraordinarily successful and progressive governor of New York. Spacing on her name, the woman, Frances Perkins, who worked as first woman cabinet member under Roosevelt. Loved Roosevelt, but she said, in truth, Al Smith was a better governor than Franklin Roosevelt. So that's how good Al Smith was. But Smith, of course, his central role in American history is that he was the first Catholic nominated for president, in which he was in 1928. And there's still an awful lot of anti-Catholic sentiment in America, and hasn't completely dissipated today. But in 1928, it really was very, very strong. And while it would have been difficult for Al Smith to have beaten Hoover that year, given the fact that the country was at peace and pretty prosperous under Republican leadership, the dimensions of his loss, the size of it, the scope of it, and the vitriol that surrounded it really shocked American Catholics. I think after World War I, when Catholics had served with distinction, I think most American Catholics in the 20s assumed that the old anti-Catholic shibboleths had gone away, but they hadn't. And so Smith would travel the country, and the Ku Klux Klan would greet him with burning crosses, a reef of explosions in Montana. There were threats on his life. Even respectable people, including Herbert Hoover's wife, questioned whether Catholics could be loyal Americans or whether they should. There was one senior general who said not only should a Catholic not be commander-in-chief, they shouldn't even be senior officers. They're only good for cannon fodder. And so that obviously stung quite a bit. And I think that the church, when they realized just it caught the church off guard. If you read Commonweal, for example, which was a publication in the 20s, they were expecting this high-tone campaign. Here was Al Smith, this great governor, and Herbert Hoover, who had been this outstanding Secretary of Commerce and this great humanitarian. This was going to be this high-planed campaign focusing on the big issues. It was going to be a credit to American democracy, and instead it's primarily about Al Smith's religion. And they were very dismayed. And so a lot of Catholics, whether they were in the hierarchy or just lay Catholics and lay Catholic leaders, after Smith lost, kind of regrouped and said, we need to do something to finally put this anti-Catholic sentiment to rest in America. And the main decision they made, the most interesting thing they made, was to aggressively move into the mass media, particularly radio and the movies, and try to get Catholicism portrayed in a positive way. And they were enormously successful in doing that. They began to have a lot of very popular shows on on radio and later into television that were, you know, both Fulton J. Sheen and others who became, you know, just obviously ordinary guys who could talk to middle America.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went into Hollywood, and it was Catholics who drafted the production code, Catholics who enforced the production code.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you saw all these very positive portrayals of Catholics in the films, like Spencer Tracy and Boys Town or Bing Crosby and Going My Way.
Yeah.
And suddenly by the 40s and 50s, instead of being an alien religion, Catholicism almost become the religion of mainstream America. Whenever Hollywood wants to portray religion in a positive light, they almost always used a Catholic, not a Protestant. And so I argue by the 50s, and of course then in the 50s, the Catholic Church is at the forefront of anti-communist movement and all that. But really, by the 1950s, when the time Kennedy starts to run for president, Catholicism, I think, is actually a benefit, not a hindrance to him.
Yeah.
Kennedy didn't always agree with that. But I think there's a strong case to be made that really...
No, I think you're right. Yeah. Certainly
Catholicism isn't the albatross it was in 1928.
Yeah.
And that's because of the changes that occurred after the shock of how Al Smith was defeated. That's a long-winded answer. I apologize.
No. I think it was fascinating because this is I've always suspected that our understanding of Kennedy, yeah, there were pockets where, you know, Kennedy's Catholicism didn't help him as much as they could have, but Kennedy still carried large swaths of the South. And you just, you know, you got to think that if Kennedy's able to carry Texas, and I know it's Johnson's on the ticket, you know, still Kennedy's at the top, that sometimes I think that historians have sort of just been like, oh yeah, there was anti-Catholic bias in 19, you know, they just sort of rely upon what happened to Al Smith as a way of explaining 1960. And it's like, well, he won after all.
He did. Well, an interesting thing is that Kennedy himself, I mean, privately, he had Ted Sorensen write up a memo in 1956 trying to convince Adlai Stevenson to put him on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And Sorensen went through all this list about exactly that. Why Catholicism is now a benefit, not a hindrance, and why you should put Kennedy on the ticket. So privately, Kennedy knew that attitudes towards Catholicism had really changed. And, you know, he was running against, again, Eisenhower's a bit like the 20s. I mean,
yeah.
He had a Republican president who was very popular. The country was at peace, pretty prosperous. There had been a recession in 59 that kind of hurt Nixon. But Nixon was also pretty popular, had always connected with middle America.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, Kennedy's feeling that he should have gotten 53% of the vote, which is kind of what he thought, and then he only gets 49%. He blamed it on Catholicism. Not really. I think it was going to be a tough race all the way around, and that Nixon was a formidable campaigner.
Yeah. No, it I think it's a telling difference between Al Smith, who was rolled in 1928, and 1960. You have, you know, Kennedy eking out a win, and, you know, there's some, you know, Democrats were the majority party at that time, but still, I mean, it's a telling. I think it's a telling difference. Let's talk kind of move to Tom Dewey again. This is another sort of, if Al Smith at least gets sort of a shout out for being the lone, you know, I guess the second now Catholic major Catholic nominee. He and John Kerry, there would be two. Is,
yep.
Am I correct?
That's
about
right.
That? Yeah,
that is correct.
And so Dewey gets absolutely no love from, you know, I think most historians. So what is Dewey's contribution as a loser?
Dewey, I think, sort of, again, this is something that's very analogous to contemporary events because Republicans are struggling with this right now.
Absolutely.
What Dewey's loss did, even though he lost twice in 44 and 48, his was a turning point in the Republican Party, in which the Republican Party accepted the concept of the welfare state and learned to accommodate it. If you look at before Dewey in the 36 and 40 elections, the Republicans are still trying to repeal the New Deal.
Yeah.
Or as Tom Dewey said, they're trying to repeal the 20th century. I tell you how Tom Dewey felt about the conservative wing of his party. But
but
with Dewey, he just believed with all his heart that if Republicans didn't understand that the public had an expectation that government was interested in their personal welfare, that the Republicans would be doomed to minority status. And so he always argued against, strongly opposed the Taft wing of the party and later the McCarthy wing and the John Birch Society as being people who were intent on destroying the Republican Party with their good intentions. And so his great benefit was that he sort of said, look, people like Social Security. They want the government to regulate the food we eat and the drugs we take and the water we drink. And we need to accommodate that. And what we as a conservative party need to do is to show how conservative principles can achieve liberal ends. Hmm. And so we need to show how we can do this primarily through local and state governments. It doesn't always have to be centralized in Washington. Mm-hmm. How we do it more efficiently so there's less waste. How we sort of adopt these things. You look at I know you guys are up there near New York, and so you know, State University of New York is a good example. Dewey, as governor, created the SUNY system, and he deliberately made it so that it was probably the least centralized state university system in the country. And he did it on purpose because he wanted to show again that local control is the best way to achieve this. But it's still important that government provide things like access to higher education, that government provide freeways, infrastructure, and all these things. And so the other thing that Dewey did after 48 was that not only did his own campaign sort of articulate this and sort of make it the standard for the Republican Party because of his two nominations, he then was instrumental in getting Eisenhower the nomination in 52 and then making sure that Nixon was Eisenhower's running mate. And so Dewey was the kingmaker in the Republican Party and really dominated the Republican Party for more than a quarter century and set the tone so the Republican Party redefined its role as not sort of, you know, going back to the 1920s, but sort of accommodating the New Deal and sort of this small this sort of sensible, as George W. Bush called it, compassionate conservatism. We understand government has a role in making lives better on a daily basis for Americans, but we have different ways of doing it, but give us the chance to do that. And so I think that was very important. Now, the modern thing, the interesting thing is, of course, now there are elements, we call them the Tea Party, that we really would like to sort of go back to that era when people would say, we got to get rid of Medicare, or we got to get rid of Social Security. These are socialist things. They're breaking the bank. They create a culture of dependency. And Dewey's advice to them was, if you do that, you're going to destroy the Republican Party, and they'll never win another election.
It's really – I find it interesting because, you know, Dewey, you know, I guess before the Bushes, you know, became the first family of establishment conservatism. I mean, Dewey is the original Mr. Establishment. And, you know, his first rival, you know, of the conservative wing, you know, Bob Taft. I mean, Bob Taft supported – I mean, I used to live in Ohio – thoroughgoing projects of public housing. I mean, you know, Bob Taft was not – you know, he was Mr. Conservative, Mr. Republican, was not nearly as conservative as the Goldwater wing, which you talk about, I think. I mean, so let's just get to Barry Goldwater. I mean, this continuing civil war, within the conservative movement. So you have Dewey able to help secure the nomination for Nixon. Nixon loses. The Democrats, you know, do their circular firing squad. But before that, you have Barry Goldwater, and you just talk about Goldwater, and his contributions.
Well, Goldwater, I mentioned that Henry Clay was a political savant. I talk about a lot of these guys. Yeah. They're political savants. They just had an intuitive understanding of politics and how to move people and shift coalitions around. And Barry Goldwater was also. Barry Goldwater used to sort of self-deprecatingly say, you know, everyone knows I don't have a first-class brain. But in fact, in some ways, he was extremely, extremely smart. In many ways, he was an extremely smart guy. And he was very interested in creating a new Republican majority, and he kept a diary, so we can know kind of what he was thinking. And as early as 1953, which was his first year in the U.S. Senate, he sat down and he said, you know, we keep writing off the South as being solidly Democratic and it's never going to change. But I think that the South and the West, the American West, have something in common, which was a natural antipathy towards the federal government. Hmm. The South because of its history as the Confederacy, and the West because of its physical removal from Washington. Both see Washington, D.C. as almost a foreign occupier.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, my mission in life is going to be to try to figure out how to create this new coalition where we bring the South into the Republican Party around a sort of Western libertarian style of conservatism. And this was really what he consciously thought, and he also had very good instincts. He realized, I suppose the downside is, even though Barry Goldwater was personally no bigot, his family's store, Goldwater's, was very enlightened in the hiring of minorities. Goldwater himself helped start the chapter of the NAACP in Arizona. He contributed to the Urban League. So I don't think anybody – I'm not suggesting Barry Goldwater was a bigot. But Goldwater realized that the key to getting the South to think about Republican was to get in past the issue of race. And so it will get Democrats to realize that they could be comfortable in the Republican Party. The Republican Party, the whole idea of the Republicans as being the party of the Reconstruction, they needed to get beyond that. And so Goldwater gave a lot of thought and came out with the book Conscience of a Conservative that he co-wrote with L. Brent Bozell.
Yeah.
And they argued that the federal government had a limited role in enforcing civil rights, that the federal government could only enforce the rights of African Americans to vote, but there was no role for the government in the Constitution to promote equal rights or equal opportunity as part of its mission. And he was one of the few Republicans to vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And this caused him to be a popular figure in the South. And so in 1964, his campaign in 1964 represents the time when the Democratic stranglehold on the South really crumbled. Eisenhower and Nixon had made a little bit of gains in the South, but Goldwater did very well, especially in the Deep South. Mississippi had never voted Republican. They gave Goldwater 87% of the vote. Now, African Americans still weren't voting in Mississippi, but Goldwater got 87% of the vote in Mississippi, a state that had never voted Republican before. So that's how dramatic the change was. And
Wow. Now
you look at the modern Republican Party,
where is
its bedrock strength? It's in the Mountain West, the Southwest,
and
it's in the South, exactly where Barry Goldwater dreamed of this alliance. And so that's why he's a very formidable figure in American political history.
I kind of skipped Adlai Stevenson because I think Stevenson and McGovern kind of obviously they go well together. And do you want to talk about maybe how Stevenson McGovern, you know, how they kind of laid the basis for the kind of contemporary Democratic Party?
I will. Again, I think that's exactly right. I think they sort of represented the next step past the New Deal.
Yeah.
Stevenson, in terms of and the interesting thing about the thing I focus on Stevenson is maybe this seems not quite as momentous as some of the other accomplishments. But one thing that sort of intrigued me about American politics is how the Democrats, the People's Party, are now known as the party of the elites. You know, the academics and sort of the Hollywood and the Manhattan, Upper East Side of Manhattan kind of crowd. When did that start? And the answer, allegedly, is that it started under Adlai Stevenson. But Stevenson was such a different kind of politician. He wasn't the old Democratic populist, didn't give the stem winders, some of the people, Tom Watson or even Harry Truman.
Yeah.
He was very erudite, very urbane, liked learning. His speeches were very different than most political speeches. You know, if you run for politics as in journalism, you're told, aim at a sixth grade education level. Don't use big words. Don't use big concepts. Talk in language people understand. Stevenson, to hell with that. I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about, and I believe that American people are smart enough to understand what I'm saying. And they did. He became a big sensation. I mean, you think of the Democrats should have had no chance in 1952. They'd had the White House for 20 years. The second term of the Truman administration had been riddled by corruption. We were stuck in Korea with no end in sight. And yet Adlai Stevenson was such a fresh face and such an appealing character that he did very well against Eisenhower and brought a lot of people into the party that previously had not considered themselves Republicans. In fact, Stevenson made great inroads, particularly in New England, which had previously, again, been just like the South had been solidly Democrat, New England had been solidly Republican. Stevenson starts bringing a lot of New Englanders into the Republican Party. And he also, with his urbanity and sort of this sense of, being appealing to intellectuals, sort of lays the groundwork for the Kennedy presidency. And Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian who worked for Kennedy, said, John Kennedy probably couldn't have been elected if Adlai Stevenson hadn't first paved the way.
Mm-hmm.
So big deal there. Then McGovern comes along, and McGovern, I think, gets credit for, again, sort of moving the Democratic Party past the New Deal coalition. It didn't seem like it was much of a success in 1972 because he got crushed by Nixon, and Democrats for decades kept saying, don't leave me with George McGovern. I'm no McGovern. But what McGovern saw, again, certainly this intuitive political genius that all these guys have, is that the New Deal coalition is disappearing.
Yeah.
Organized labor's numbers are decreasing. The urban ethnics are moving to the suburbs, and their kids are going to college, and they're becoming Republicans. We're losing the South. We've lost the South. I think McGovern already understood that in 1972. So we need to replace it with a new coalition, and he thought the coalition should revolve around minorities, around women, especially working women, and around the young, and people who are caring about sort of new emerging issues like the environment. And that wasn't a very big coalition in 1972, especially like Hispanics. McGovern was the first candidate to explicitly reach out to Hispanic voters, the first to reach out specifically gay voters. So that coalition was pretty small in 1972, and he got creamed.
Yeah.
But what did the coalition that Barack Obama has now ridden for two successful elections? Well, it's been focused on minorities. It's been focused on women. It's been focused on the young.
Yeah.
And so McGovern created the modern Democratic coalition that has allowed Obama to be the first Democrat since Roosevelt to win two elections with more than 50% of the vote.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, McGovern was, I guess one could say, prescient. You know, you wouldn't have said that in 1972, but I think he's been, you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the Obama coalition is the McGovern coalition. And I loved it that you included Ross Perot, because I think, you know, some of Ross Perot's kind of, especially, what was that? He had the debate with Al Gore on Larry King about NAFTA, and Gore just sort of cleaned his clock. And
yeah, that was kind of the end of Ross Perot.
But you could talk, I mean, I couldn't agree more than how important Ross Perot was in 1992 and again in 1996. I mean, I think most of my family actually voted for Ross Perot. But you could just talk about his importance?
I will. I think there are two tracks. One thing we mentioned earlier about how third parties, or any losing candidate, if they have good ideas, the winning candidates or some future people will take them away and make them their own. And Perot, I think, that a lot. I mean, really, if you look at he was obviously known for the deficit reduction, and that had always been a kind of concern of conservatives and liberals for a long time, but he sort of made it the focal point.
Yeah.
And son of a gun, we had enough economic growth in the 90s, the deficit did disappear. But he had a lot of other reforms he talked about that people thought made sense, because people thought our political establishment is broken and that needed to be reformed. And so Perot was the one who tossed out really popularized issues like term limits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the Republicans saw that. And in 1994, if you go look at the contract with America that Newt Gingrich developed that led to so many Republican victories in the congressional races that year, it's a laundry list of what things Perot had been advocating.
Yeah.
You know, term limits, balanced budget amendments, limitations on money and politics, all the things that Perot had talked about. So he profoundly impacted the Republican Party and had them adopt a lot of his notion that Republicans are the reformers of a broken political system. And I think that's a very important legacy of his. The other legacy he left, I think, though, is also this notion that we need to go outside the political system to find our leaders. I point out that really for 150 years plus, Americans never thought that business tycoons would make good presidents. Nobody tried to draft Henry Ford or J.P. Morgan or John D. Rockefeller for president. Everyone sort of thought that requires a different set of skills than running the country. But then beginning in the 80s, partly because of Reagan's sort of, the preeminence of the business community in the Reagan years, people started to say, you know, I really like that Lee Iacocca guy. If he can do that with Chrysler, what could he do with the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Iacocca demurred as Peter Ubroth, but Ross Perot, you know, he thought maybe he would make a pretty good president. And so he ran. And I think a lot of people believe that, and it sort of sets this tone that's still out there, that the system is so corrupt, we need somebody outside and somebody who's so wealthy that they aren't beholden to anybody's interest. They aren't out there begging for money. They're independently wealthy, so they're above politics.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that now replicated many times. You saw it, I think, with Bloomberg in New York City. You saw it with Schwarzenegger in California. You've seen it with a number of people who've run from the business world or from the celebrity entertainment world, that people say, this is the person who's going to come in and rescue the system. And I think without Ross Perot, we would still generally have sort of pretty conventional politics, which is you work your way up the ranks. Maybe some people skip their turn, like Kennedy or Reagan, but you work your way up the ranks until you're nominated. And now there's always this constant look, Donald Trump last year and Herman Cain both. Where can we find somebody outside the system who can come in and we can trust? And I think that's an important legacy of Ross Perot, too.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, maybe you wouldn't, you know, the modern Tea Party, the citizen legislator. You know, this is, you know, you don't need to work your way up through the Republican ranks. You can just be an insurgent and run. And so Chapter 11 was sort of like, I guess, the latest losers. Gore, Kerry, McCain.
Yeah, let's talk about them. Yeah. Why I highlight them, obviously, because I figured there's interest in the most recent election.
Yeah,
but I highlight them because what do you do with the losers? I mean, that's always been an ongoing question for a while now. And in the old days, in the 19th, and that's also I talk about a little bit in the book. I'd like to have talked about it more, but a lot of reasons I didn't. But sort of the evolution of how we feel about losers and losing generally in American society. We've now become hyper-competitive, where if you're identified as a loser, we have nothing to do with you. We want only successful people. Only winners is all we're looking for in America. Winning is the only thing. That wasn't always true. I think we were much more tolerant of losing in the 19th century, and so Henry Clay could lose, but still go back to Congress and play a very pivotal role. Stephen Douglas, Bryan, all these people were still widely admired characters even after they lost.
Yeah.
But then beginning with the age of television, and I guess it's because of the visual images are so powerful, once you became sort of identified as a loser and you had pictures that sort of proved it, people just kind of disappeared, and they went quietly away. I mean, you know, McGovern hung around in the Senate for a few years. Humphrey went back, but neither one were major players. They both complained they weren't treated the same. They were treated as yesterday's news. Their influence was severely limited, and some people just completely, seemed to disappear. Mondale kind of disappeared. Dole, resigned from the Senate before the election and occasionally pops up, but didn't do much. So Dukakis went into teaching.
Yeah.
And so what I credit Kerry, Gore, and McCain with is that they're trying to redefine the role of loser by sort of reestablishing this notion that they're still relevant, that they had a large following. Gore, obviously, on climate change, didn't come back into politics per se, but tried to find other ways to influence the global debate on climate change, both with his books, his movies, his TV channel. That Kerry had gone back to the Senate and didn't take sort of a junior position like Humphrey and McGovern had to, but became chair of Senate Foreign Relations, is now going to be probably the first a losing candidate since Charles Evans Hughes to get a senior cabinet position in an administration.
Yeah.
He'll be Secretary of State. That hasn't happened since Hughes. I mean, Adlai Stevenson got to be UN ambassador, but that's not a big post.
Yeah.
And then McCain has sort of almost tried to recapture what used to be called the titular head, the role of the titular head of the party, by being the main spokesperson commenting on the winning administration. He's on the Sunday talk shows all the time criticizing the Obama administration, which was a role, again, hadn't been performed since Adlai Stevenson was kind of the official spokesperson for the Democrats for 8 years. So all three men trying really hard to be relevant and to stay vital and to use the capital they gained as presidential nominees to further the agendas they care about. And again, looking at the 2012 election, another sort of disappointment about Mitt Romney, the first candidate in history that I can recall, certainly in modern times, who just didn't even give a post-election speech or press conference, has not written an op-ed column, hasn't injected himself into the debate at all, but is sort of falling more the mold, like I said, of a Dukakis or a Dole or a Mondale, which is, well, I guess I lost. I'll just go back and do something different. So we'll see how things play out over time. But I'd like to think that the Gore, Kerry, and McCain model is going to continue, because I do think these losers – first of all, they're outstanding public servants, so they wouldn't have got a nomination. And then they must have learned so much in running a presidential campaign. It's a shame to lose that knowledge and not utilize it for the good of the country.
No, I couldn't agree more. I particularly enjoyed, your point about that, and sort of, thinking about Gore and it's nice to see Kerry and McCain, to go back to the Senate and to kind of and not be like Humphrey. You know, I always felt so bad. You know, what was it? Humphrey took 2 years off, returned in 1970, but it was never the same. And Kerry and McCain, my impression is that they're valued by their Senate colleagues, still valued. I mean, this just, and then you have an appendix where you talk about even, the folks you couldn't give a full treatment. I mean, this is a really great book. I mean, this is really wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Can you tell us, or do you have something else that you're working on? That's our typical last question is that. I mean, not that you have to be, but what's next?
Well, no, and in fact, it's interesting. I see your book is coming out this fall, and I was reading about the Vital Center just last night, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
I'm doing a book comparing the persons and presidencies of Ronald Reagan and John Kennedy. And I had sort of struck me one day that nobody had ever put these two together in a book and sort of compared them, even though they're contemporaries. They're only 6 years apart in age, and Reagan is actually older than Kennedy. But just how they are the defining icons of the presidency. Kennedy, the icon of the left, Reagan, the icon of the right. Gallup polls over the last 15 years have shown that Americans consistently rank Reagan and Kennedy as two of the three greatest presidents in history. Only Lincoln knocks one of those two off occasionally as the greatest president, which is an amazing thing when you think about it.
Yeah.
And so the book explores why have their legacies endured? Why are they still the gold standard for what we hope our presidents look like, what they sound like, and frankly also what their policies we want? That was the revelation to me, is their policies were actually far more similar than the partisans of each man want to acknowledge. So maybe there is a vital center in American politics where left and right meet, and there are some parameters where Americans want our presidents to be, and maybe future presidential candidates ought to keep that in mind.
You know, I did read this somewhere that it was Kennedy was the president that Reagan quoted most, actually. And it's an interesting, I mean, Reagan was such a borrower of both kind of FDR and Kennedy. It sounds like a really great book. I look forward to it.
And I look forward to reading yours. I hope it comes out soon.
Yeah, in June, it will be out. Well, Scott Ferris, thank you very much for talking about your book, Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. This is put out by Lions Press, and it's a real page turner, and not just a great read, but, deeply informed. So I really appreciate it, and I urge all the listeners to go out and get a copy.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it, and my best to you and everybody at Gannon.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you, you too.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Scott Ferris. More importantly, I hope you're motivated to go out and buy Almost President. Read it. Tell your friends about it. And then tune in next week for another interview with another author of another really interesting book about politics. Talk to you next week.